done a pretty decent job of managing hazards. You can do better, you will do better, you need to do better, but a pretty decent job of managing hazard and a terrible job of managing outrage. And that's why you're in the trouble you're in. Okay. That's where we're going. Now, in the research literature, there are at least, 28, 29 variables that show up as what I'm calling components of outrage. Okay, you won't see them in the literature as components of outrage, not unless I wrote the literature. They're in the literature as correlates of public misperception of risk. Okay, and I hope I'm in process of convincing you that that's the wrong way to see the problem. Okay, that if you see the problem as public misperception, the problem's going to get worse. Now, we don't have time for 28 or 29. I'm going to discuss today 12 that seem to me the dominant components of outrage. And then I have a B list of another 8 that I will go through very quickly toward the end of the presentation. The first one that we're going to talk about is the distinction between risks that are voluntary and risks that are coerced. What I want you to do is think for a minute about the distinction between, on the one hand, deciding to go on a skiing trip, and on the other hand, having somebody rouse you out of bed in the middle of the night, shanghai you to the top of a mountain, strap slippery sticks to the bottom of your feet, and push you down the mountain. Okay. Now, we don't usually think this way, but it's worth noticing the experience on the way down the mountain is exactly the same. Right? When sliding down a mountain is sliding down a mountain. Nonetheless, one of these is recreation, the other is assault with a deadly weapon. Okay? And we have no trouble telling the difference, right? If I decide you're going to slide down the mountain, that's assault. If you decide you're going to slide down the mountain, you're on holiday. Okay? Now, that's true not just for skiing, but across a very wide range of risky behaviors. If the behavior is voluntary, it shows up in the literature as much as 3 orders of magnitude more acceptable than if it's coerced. I like saying things like 3 orders of magnitude. It makes me feel like I'm technical, too. For those of you from the public affairs department, that's up to 1,000 times as acceptable if it's voluntary as if it's coerced. That's a larger difference than you usually get in social science. Okay. And it's not just individual behavior. Okay. It applies to community behaviors as well. Think, for example, about sighting of controversial facilities. Okay, and let's imagine 2 very different sighting scenarios. Okay? In scenario 1, a company comes into town and it says, look, we'd like to put our dimethyl meatloaf factory here. We don't care whether you want it here or not. We own the land. We own the zoning board. We own the regulatory agencies. If you don't like it, you can move. Okay? Some of you are smiling like, those were the good old days. And a few of you are looking puzzled like, well, isn't that how it's done? Now, in scenario 2, the company comes into town and it says, look, we'd like to put our dimethyl meatloaf factory here, but only if you want it here. So here's what we're going to do. We'd like to give you a small technical assistance grant so you can hire your own expert to advise you on what the risks and benefits really are. Okay. Then we want you to convene a negotiating team, and we'll talk. We'll talk about mitigation. We'll talk about compensation. Maybe you want us to bond for property values. Maybe you want stipulated penalties, so if something goes wrong, you can sue us without having to go to regulatory agencies. Whatever you want, we'll talk about. And if at the end of that negotiation we can agree on terms such that you now want us to build a facility and we still want to build it, we'll sign a contract and we'll build it. If we can't agree on terms, we won't build it. Guaranteed, in writing, in advance. Now some of you are looking like, why did we invite a communist to come speak? Okay. And I understand that a voluntary sighting might not work. Most of you understand that a coerced sighting also might not work. It's hard to cite controversial facilities. One of the things that is guaranteed, though, is that under the second scenario, the public is going to consider dimethyl meatloaf a lot less risky than under the first scenario. Okay. That's guaranteed. The right to say no makes saying maybe a much smaller risk. Okay. And I mean that literally. This is not a metaphor. Okay, I mean it literally. Again, think about skiing. What does a skier say when a non-skier says, you're crazy, you're going to kill yourself, don't do it? Do skiers say, yeah, I know it's risky, but I really love it? I don't think so. Maybe if they work for EPA, they say that. Okay, but most skiers will say, come on, it's not really risky. Right? What does that mean? Does that mean they don't know the hazard data? They know the hazard data. They see the medical corpsmen skiing down the mountain with fractured people. Okay? They know the hazard data. They still assert that skiing isn't risky. And the reason is very straightforward. Skiing is voluntary. Because it's voluntary, it generates no outrage. Because it generates no outrage, it is literally not very risky, because outrage is most of what we mean by risk. However, it's extraordinarily hazardous. What do you do about that? Okay. If you're in a situation where outrage is high, what do? You try to find ways to make the risk more voluntary. Now, I say more voluntary because voluntary is not an on-off switch. It's not a dichotomy. How many of you are parents? Lots of parents. Everyone who's ever raised a child knows that good parenting is finding a middle range between fascism and chaos. Okay? And I'm talking about parenting, I'm not suggesting that communities are children. I am suggesting that we already have a precedent in our lives for finding a middle on voluntariness. The second component I want to talk about is the distinction between risks that are natural and risks that are industrial. I think you can think of a natural risk as kind of midway between a voluntary risk and a coerced risk. It's much more acceptable than a coerced risk. It's somewhat less acceptable than a voluntary risk. It's kind of God's coercion. Okay, and we are all of us more forgiving of God than we are of multinational corporations. Okay, this is a distinction some of you may have trouble making. Okay? But the public doesn't. Okay, and we cut slack for God in a way that we don't cut slack for agencies or corporations, presumably in the hope that God will eventually return the favor. Okay. So a very good example of this, I think, is radon. In New Jersey, where I lived until very recently, according to our state DEP, 30% of the homes in North Jersey had enough radon in their basements to represent an excess lifetime lung cancer risk of somewhere between 1 in 100 and 3 in 100. 30% of the homes had enough radon. They're just living in their house all their lives, elevated people's cancer risk by 1 to 3%. Now, that's a huge risk. I mean, if you have anything on your desk that represents a cancer risk to the community of 1 in 10,000, you're talking about a serious hazard. 1 in 100,000 is worth regulating. We're moving toward 1 in a million. And I'm talking 1 in 100 to 3 in 100, and we can't get people to spend $20 on a charcoal canister to test. Now, if some corporation were going door to door, putting radon in people's basements, then we'd have no trouble getting them to test. Okay. But because it's God's radon, not a corporation's radon, because it's a natural risk, not an industrial risk, it generates enormously less outrage. In fact, in the only place in New Jersey where radon isn't natural, some of you may know this story. There was, at the turn of the century, a luminescent paint factory. They added radium to paints to make the paints glow in the dark. They don't do that anymore. And their slag was, of course, radium contaminated. It got used as landfill. Homes got built on top of it. Same problem as natural radon, or almost the same. A little different ratio of beta to gamma to alpha, but almost the same problem as natural radon. Instead of coming from uranium in the rock and soil, it's coming from radium in the landfill. Okay? But now it's not God's radon anymore. It's some company's radon, and when the DEP, the State Department of Environmental Protection, dug several tens of thousands of barrels of this stuff up and tried to move it to another place, to another site, to Vernon, New Jersey, they precipitated the largest civil disobedience in New Jersey since the Vietnam War. Okay. I mean, people lying down or swearing, signing pledges that they would lie down in front of trucks sooner than let this radon-contaminated soil, radium-contaminated soil, come into their town. Notwithstanding the fact that the level of radiation in the average basement in Vernon is about the same as the level of radiation that would have been generated in the quarry where they were planning to dispose of the soil. Okay. And people knew that. People knew that. People went to hearings and they said, it's bad enough, I've got this crap in my basement. Okay. You're not going to move any more of it into my town. You know, graphic evidence of the difference between a natural and an industrial risk. What do you do about that? I could say, gee, try to make all the risks you impose on people natural, but you can't. So what you have to do is remember that they're not natural and not seem to be pretending that they're natural. Okay? And the way this normally goes wrong is with risk comparisons. Lots and lots of people, experts, when they are trying, and I think in good faith, trying to explain to the public why the risk is not something to worry about, will use a comparison to a natural risk. If you're talking acute risk, it's usually getting hit by lightning on the golf course. If you're talking chronic risk, it's usually aflatoxin in peanut butter. How many of you have used or heard used comparisons of that sort? Okay, nearly all of you. Now, let me tell you how that sounds to citizens. It sounds like what you're saying is, if you think what we're doing to you is bad, check out what God is doing to you. And if you're not angry at God, you've got no right to be angry at us. And people walk away thinking, that company or that agency thinks they're God, which may exacerbate a problem you have anyway. So the moral of the story is natural risk and industrial risk are judged on a different metric, always will be, they should be. In hazard terms, they're not, but in outrage terms, they are and always will be. And therefore, any time you compare an industrial risk that you are responsible for with a natural risk that God is responsible for, trying to argue that yours isn't as bad as God's, the argument is going to backfire and outrage is going to increase. Number three is the distinction between risks that are familiar and risks that are exotic. I can use radon as an example of this one as well. Radon, as most of you know, is a decay product of uranium in the soil, rises through the rock and soil. If it happens to hit the surface under your house, it rises into your basement where it concentrates and threatens you with lung cancer. Well, I stopped being afraid of my basement when I was 5 years old. Very hard to get people to take a risk seriously when it strikes us in such familiar turf as their own home. You know, my home is my castle, is my sanctuary. We say safe as houses. Okay, it's hard to take a risk seriously in your own house. Similarly, a lot of you know that inside manufacturing facilities, the biggest risk communication problem is excessive familiarity. Okay, that is to say, with workers, they are so familiar with the risks, the outrage goes down. Pretty soon, workers aren't taking the precautions seriously, that the exposure rate is going up, the accident rate is going up, and that the dominant risk communication problem is to figure out how to keep people worried. Outside the factory, you're likely to have exactly the opposite problem. I don't know what's going out your stacks. I don't know what's in the flare. I don't know what's in all those barrels. I don't know what the funny smell is. And the more things I don't know, the more outrage I'm going to experience. A beautiful example of this, I think, is the Superfund cleanup. There are occasionally Superfund cleanups. It's not real common, but it does happen. And one of the things that we've noticed is just as the cleanup begins, or more properly, just as the remedial investigation begins, they're about to reduce the hazard, okay? And almost invariably the outrage goes through the roof. Okay? And the principal reason, I think, is familiarity. It was a familiar puddle of crud. Okay? Unattractive, but familiar. Hey, I'll meet you by the lagoon. And suddenly it goes high tech. There's a trailer camp of consultants. They're sinking high pressure injection wells. They're bringing a rotary kiln incinerator to the site. People walking around in moon suits. I mean, talk about double messages. Did you ever have anybody knock on your door in a moon suit? Just testing your drinking water. Nothing to worry about. Well, all that high tech paraphernalia, it increases the outrage enormously. Okay, so just as the hazard's about to go down, because a familiar risk becomes an exotic risk, the outrage goes up. And the solution is very obvious given this diagnosis. The solution is very straightforward. It's make the risk more familiar. Okay, it's displays in shopping malls. It's K-12 education curriculum materials. It's plant tours. For the Superfund example, have a little media event the week before the cleanup starts in front of City Hall where you let kids walk around in the moon suits. Okay? You demythologize the technology. You demythologize the risk. You make people familiar with the risk. Now, notice I'm not saying make people familiar with the benefits. Oftentimes, companies in particular think, if only people understood how wonderful this product is, how good it is for the society, then things would be much better. And that's sometimes useful, but it's not nearly as useful as companies imagine. What we're talking about when we talk about familiarity is exactly the opposite of the intuition, the instinct of a lot of corporate folks, and I think a lot of government folks as well. Okay. Your instinct is, gee, we want to reassure people, we better not tell them anything about the risk. We better not tell them anything scary if we're trying to reassure them. Okay. And it turns out, that sounds like it ought to make sense, but it turns out it usually works the other way. Okay. Because you're not telling us, because we're not familiar with the risks, instead of being reassured, we are very alarmed. We are alarmed by what we don't understand. Most of us can see this if we go outside our own field. Imagine, for example, imagine the issue of accidental nuclear war. And let's look at two different Pentagon speeches on accidental nuclear war. Okay? In speech one, the Pentagon says, oh, we never worry about accidental nuclear war. Couldn't happen. You know, it's a figment of Peacenik's imagination. Okay? In speech two, the Pentagon says, oh, yeah, accidental nuclear war, we worry a lot about that. We've got a whole division that goes to bed every night, gets up every morning, trying to figure out ever more sophisticated ways to make sure we'll never have an accidental nuclear war. We think we're doing a good job. We think we've got the problem under control, but we never give up. We take that problem very seriously. Which speech is more reassuring? The second one. Which speech usually gets given? The first one. So the goal is to make us familiar with the risks, level with us about the risks, so they lose some of that capacity to provoke outrage. Number four is the distinction between risks that are memorable and risks that are not memorable. And the list says not memorable because in each case I want to look at the safe side of the dichotomy, the safe side of the scale, and the safe side of this one is not memorable. What does memorability mean? Memorability is kind of the flip side of familiarity. If familiarity is to what extent have you lived with a risky situation without anything going wrong, memorability is how easy is it for you to envision something going wrong.